she's my mom.
I'm Ken.
And I'm Doug. So thank you for being here. Today, I'm going to talk about something out of the, it's called the Karika by Nagarjuna, who was an early Buddhist scholar and master and is our 14th ancestor. He lived about 150 to 250 Common Era, and he wrote about the middle path. And what I'm going to pass out here is the dedication that he wrote in Sanskrit with an English translation. And I want to talk about part of it, but Nagarjuna was not the founder of the Madhyamaka school, the middle way, but he really developed it. He was a South Indian fellow who was, I could see why they would call him a philosopher, because philosophers deal with logic and sets of things that are inclusive and things that are separate. And as you'll see in what we'll read here, this middle paragraph of six lines, it gives a taste of this fellow. So let's skip the Sanskrit part, but just read together these six lines that start with, I salute him. I salute him, the fully enlightened, the best of speakers, who preached the non-ceasing and the non-arising, the non-annihilation and the non-permanence, the non-identity and the non-difference, the non-appearance and the non-disappearance, the dependent arising, the appeasement of obsessions, and the auspicious. So what I'm going to talk about is actually the third line of the Sanskrit that talks about ya prati ta tai yasamut param prapan ko pasam sivam. And I give a little definitions below what we just read there, where prati tai samut param is dependent arising, and prapan ko pasam samam is the appeasement of obsessions, and that's specifically what I'd like to talk about. And then shivam is the auspiciousness, and it's also translated as nirvana, and I would include like a state of grace that's achieved through all of this. So today in the service, we chanted the confessional text that's done on full moons, and some people do it on new moons. And even though the full moon is not up, our full sun is up, the full moon is on the other side of the planet, I figured we could chant this in the daytime instead of at nighttime, just to wash ourselves of our mistakes. It's chanting about all our twisted karma is one thing, what is done in communities, spiritual communities, to kind of wash themselves of their mistakes for the month, their shortcomings, what have you. And so this, in a way, is after kind of the cleansing of that part of the ceremony, I offer this, which is a dedication to Buddha that Nagarjuna has at the, it's in his introduction to this, the Karika, his treatise on the middle way. And somehow I'll wrap this all together. The the non-ceasing and the non-arising that he talks about here, some of the commentary on what he's written talks about the non-ceasing and the non-arising. You know, what is non-ceasing would be eternal. What is non-arising could also be looked at eternally. But basically, there was a big divisions within Buddhism, and there were the nihilists that believed that everything had to be annihilated, all of our passions had to be annihilated, all of our delusions. And then there were the eternalists as well. And so he wanted to come to the middle of that. So, of course, if there's non-ceasing, there's also ceasing. If there's non-arising, there is arising. For example, our breath is a good example of that, where as we begin our breath, our inhalation, it is arising. And as it begins to cease, our exhalation is arising. And as our exhalation is ceasing, our inhalation is arising. So we have this arising and ceasing, and even though as one is arising, the other is ceasing, together the breath is the breath. And is that non-ceasing and non-arising? And it just does something to our thinking to consider this, and that's why I offer it. It goes on to talk about non-annihilation and non-permanence. And I'm big into the non-permanence part of stuff. I like to, one person called me the destroyer because I like to pull stumps out of the ground or move dirt or dig a hole or, you know, but basically I'm not destroying the dirt. The dirt's just getting moved. It remains the dirt. It is in a new pile somewhere, and it's often not very pretty, and that's where Giroux comes in. And Giroux is the arising of beauty comes about through Giroux by like taking something that we destroyed, like a bay laurel tree with these big rounds, and he examines them to see what's the best surface of it and what's the top and bottom and then where will it go. And he even, before it's placed, he places it in the dirt. He sees its shape. He sees where it needs to go. He digs the hole. If it's an odd-shaped piece, he already carves it into the dirt, and then it gets moved into place, and it's just adjusted and set there. So he fully places these things, and it's an arising. To me, it's an example of the non-annihilation. And so these qualities that are expressed and dedicated to the Buddha are things that we all manifest. And so I offer this to you as not only a dedication to Buddha, but a dedication to each of our Buddha natures. So one of the real interesting things in this text to me is he at the bottom he talks about the appeasement of obsessions. And appeasement has many meanings. And I think these different meanings help us to understand what we do with our obsessions. Appeasement, often, usually you appease your enemy and you basically give up. It's not quite surrender, but it's almost, is one way of looking at appeasement. But strictly speaking, the definition of appeasement includes pacifying, calming, the subsiding of obsessions, the quenching, the quelling, the soothing of obsessions, the easing, the assuaging of obsessions, the moderating of obsessions. And obsessions can be defined in a lot of ways as well. It can be our very strong attachments, our very strong passions, our expectations, our preoccupations, our habits, our addictions, our anxieties, our fears, our hang-ups, our fixations, even our repressions, our prejudices can be obsessions. And I want to tell a little story about a little switch in one of these that one of my friends at work shared. He's from Boston. He's a short Irishman from Boston who speaks very fast, and he's also a very, very good guy. He's about my age. And one of his childhood friends came from Boston to visit him with his wife, and he came out here to Marin to stay with Jack and his wife. And both of them are open, accepting, generous, fundamentally unprejudiced people. I'm sure they have still remnants of it, but they're progressive thinking. Jack said he was brought up with his dad was fully, his dad and his grandfather were fully aware of how prejudiced in Boston they were of the Irish, because there would be signs, no Irish or black need apply. And so when they would, as kids, do their games where they would go around the circle to eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a nigger by the toe. Don't ever say nigger. We don't do that in our house. And yet everybody else in that community that he lived in were Archie Bunkers, were people that were strongly prejudiced, had real strong passions, didn't like the Italians, didn't like if they were Northern Irish, they didn't like the Southern Irish, the Protestant Irish, they didn't like a lot of things they didn't like. And but Jack pretty much got over all that. And so he's visited by his childhood friend who moved from Boston to Florida, and he now runs a bar there. And sitting around the table, they would be talking, and he would be talking about, yeah, there's so many, he would use the N-word, and he would use the F-word for gays, and would basically, just spouting what he normally was thinking and feeling. And it really drove Jack and his wife nuts for 3 days. But on the third day, Jack pulled him aside and must have slapped him across the head and said, you weren't like this as a kid. How come you're carrying all this with you like you are now? And he said, well, I run a bar. I'm in a small town in Florida, and it's like that's how people are. That's how they talk. And so he shook him. He just shook him in some way that he began to see that here in the Bay Area, all the different nationalities get along, and there's just a sense of peace and acceptance. And then he said, and where are the gays? I came to San Francisco. Where are all the gays? They're here. They're in your town. He was just kind of, he was getting ribbed by his friends back in Florida that, he was going to the gay capital of the universe. And so by the time he left, he said he would proudly wear a San Francisco sweatshirt back in Florida. Maybe it should have been a t-shirt since it's pretty hot there. And let the guys in the bar that come into his bar say, so you're a fag now. What are you? And because he's the kind of guy who will get in their face, but he needed some help to turn, to flip. And Jack helped that. So one person at a time, one person at a time in our encounters in our lives, you know, people change slightly. They get, it's like, so I got something out of this. And so in a way he assuaged one of his obsessions. And really the guy had to do it himself, but you know, we all get help from wherever we can. So that's one example. Another is kind of obsession to me are expectations that people have. And my partner, 37 years, has, when we were married, we had one of our vows that we had, Katagiri Roshi married us. And so we had a Buddhist ceremony, but I also, you know, we crafted our vows. But the first vow that was mainly my idea, so I guess it's my vow, was no expectations. And, you know, we both read it together and, you know, lived our life, but it really helped me a lot of times, because in the role as a husband and as a father, as the breadwinner, as the male in the house, you know, that I can have all sorts of expectations on when dinner should be served, on, you know, all sorts of realms in the house. But the no expectation part for me didn't allow that. So I, as a construction worker, being going out and jackhammering concrete or setting forms for concrete or moving dirt or soil or rock, come home really tired, and my wife would have our 2, 3, 4 boys. We had them all in a short period of time. She had them out. She had them interested in stuff, but dinner would not be ready. So I'd come home beat from working all day, but, you know, recognizing how much work she did with each of the children, that it is an inordinate amount of work that, as a guy, I didn't have to do because I was off with my shovel and wheelbarrow and jackhammer, you know, with nobody bugging me, where she had these little bugs just, you know, feed me, take me, I'm interested, I'm sleepy, my pants are full of poop. You know, just whatever it is that came up, she had to deal with. And so when I'd come home tired and the dinner would not be ready, I realized I couldn't expect her to have dinner ready, because she worked hard with these little monkeys. So I chopped the onions and got the rice going and chopped the vegetables and, you know, I cooked. And so we could eat, and everybody, all the kids would eat, and I'd eat all the leftovers because I was hungry. But it was good. You know, I didn't have this residue of like, well, there's one that she didn't do for me. But instead, it was like I couldn't even do that. I had to let her, trust her fully that she did what was best in her day every single moment. I had to trust that fully and not put on top of that some other expectations that would impair that functioning of how well she took care of our kids. So by vowing sometimes, we can, it helps us eliminate some of these problematic conditions that we get hooked with, that often we don't even notice, because when you normally have your expectations and somebody doesn't meet them because they look at things completely differently, like I expect Jero to see the rock the same way I do, and he sees it 90 degrees different than I do, so we argue about it. So who's right? Who's wrong? Well, I let him have the last word usually, so far. because there's a whole different, he brings a whole different set of conditions and knowledge to that rock than what I have, where I have my preferences. So these exchanges are important to unwrap, to appease these, to nullify, to pacify these conditions. One of the other obsessions that can be defined is you can talk of delusions, you can talk of desires, appeasing our delusions, appeasing our desires, and we chant, beings are numberless, I vow to save them, delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. In some Zen temples, they chant, desires are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. But how do you put an end to a desire? Do you just go, whack, I'm not hungry? When you're really hungry, you say, oh, that's a desire, stop it. Or there are all these other desires we have, and how do you modify them? How do you pacify them? And I need Cliff's help here on what Coben said about desires. When he said,
desires are infinite, they will find an end of themselves.
Desires are infinite, they will find an end in themselves or of themselves?
I think of themselves, but I'm not sure. Either one works, I think.
Yeah. So desires do come to an end. You know, when we're hungry, we eat. It assuages our hunger. When we're gasping for air, we breathe and slow down, and slowly we get modified. And so the middle way, what Nagarjuna talks about, is to appease our obsessions, not to just whack them off. And so I think this gives, as Buddhists, as human beings, of whatever lineage or culture, I think that you know, having ways to deal with our human condition and the problems that arise for us, there are ways to get there. And this little, I guess the top four lines could be considered a four-line gatha. But it gives a clue in how we can live our lives. So as before taking questions, what I'd like to do is to have us read this one more time, only this time I'd like you to personalize it. So the women can say, I salute her, to recognize your own Buddha nature. But to read this as a salute to our own Buddha nature. I salute him, the fully enlightened, the best speakers, who preach the non-ceasing, the non-rising, the non-annihilation and the non-permanence, the non-identity and the non-difference, the non-appearance and the non-disappearance, the dependent arising, the appeasement of obsessions, and the auspicious. Preach is a loaded word. I think we can include the definition of preach to include ways that we conduct our life that don't include words. And just by the example of how we work and carry ourselves and sit, we're in a way preaching, but there are many other ways of saying that. So I would include the nonverbal teachings we get from others and that we can share with others as part of how we manifest these qualities. So any thoughts anybody has?
That it, in my thinking about it, that it always involves some kind of fixation. You're fixed on something. It's not just you meet something or you like something or you desire something, but in the meeting of something or an activity or a point of view or something like that, there's a holding on, there's a fixed quality about that. So and then when I think about the appeasement of that, then it feels like relief, a lighter quality or kind of relief.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of the title of the Uchiyama's book, Opening the Hand of Thought. And Michael talked about fixing on something, that the mind has fixed ideas. Thoughts sort of petrify, and this, you're right, this is the way it is. And the whole idea of appeasement, Mike was suggesting there's a kind of lightness, that not being bothered by thoughts and these fixed ideas, but sometimes it feels like a lot more than appeasement is necessary with a fixed idea. Like you spoke of shaking some. Sometimes we have to be really shook up before we can let go of this fixation. And sometimes I think about this opening the hand of thought as this, just prying the fingers open so that we can let go of something that we're holding onto in a very fixed way. So appeasement doesn't, I don't know, with an obsession, sometimes it feels like a lot more than appeasement is necessary.
Digging out the roots.
Mm-hmm.
One at a time, but there's, the process of pacifying is a slow process, and usually it involves examining the causes and conditions of that fixation. For example, a close friend has just hired an attorney, and the attorney missed an appointment by an hour, and also wasn't keeping my friend fully informed. And so my friend had very high expectations that there'd be prompt, they would be professional, they would be fully informing, because my friend's paying the bill. And yet the attorney fell down on the job and was let know the shortcomings. But there were high expectations, and it was just like whittling away at to tighten it. Sometimes you have to tighten it. And Joe does that all the time during teaching ceremonial tea. And maybe he loosens it at times too. But then there's times to... So I think it's probably, you know, the creaking of opening the hand of thought is part of it, is the appeasement. It's not just one way of appeasing. I think it's important to consider so many other... That's why I gave a long list of other synonyms for that word, because I think depending on the condition, the timing, the type, there are so many different ways of dealing with our fixations. Yeah. Yes, just true.
To me, it seems that the word appeasement was very deliberately chosen, because in my experience, the confrontation of obsession generally doesn't work. It's like if you're in an adversarial position with someone, to come up against them like this, or with a lot of force, frequently has the opposite reaction, just strengthening the other side. And in my own personal experience with obsessions, it's exactly what happens for me. The direct confrontation of an obsession, the force, the almost will to stop it, results in almost like strengthening the obsession. So the idea of appeasement, almost like coming in the side door, sort of, and addressing this in an oblique way, almost, seems to me, for me, to make some kind of sense.
It also seems to imply a kind of friendliness toward the problem or the issue at hand.
At least not a resistance to it in a sense. So to me, I like that word. I don't exactly mm-hmm. understand it completely,
mm-hmm.
but the idea of letting go. There seems to be an aspect of letting go on this side in an appeasement, letting go of my fixed ideas about this situation that I'm in relationship with. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, the side door. Maybe it could be plural, side doors, because it's not just from the side, from the bottom. There are other ways to approach a problem instead of just dealing with it head on. There are times when you have to, but there's other ways of exploring it. And so, I mean, our practice is a contemplative practice. And so maybe with the obsessions, to examine them and the conditions, the causes of them, allow us to find those side doors that might bring in fresh air to start to change things a little. Cliff?
I think this is as important as you think it is while you are thinking about it.
Say that again, please.
That's another side door.
Yeah.
Just realize.
Nothing is as important as you think it is while you're thinking it.
Mm-hmm. to quote from a psychologist named Kahneman, who became very famous for proving that all of us, all humans, are very biased and very much subject to self-interest and parochial views and so on. He did it scientifically and wrote a book about it and won a Nobel Prize.
Mado, again? Or Todd?
This friend, his father, great Stanford engineer, he said, hopeless but not serious.
I've heard that. I don't get that. Can you talk more about it?
Hopeless. Well, hopelessness, what would that be? Hope is a little different than serious, I guess. Hope is hopelessness, you know. What would that mean? What do you think that would mean?
Don't do that. I've heard that expression, and I just have never understood it. I would love to.
I like the feeling that it gives me, hopelessness, but it's not really that serious. So you're obsessed upon something, and it's like, oh gosh, you know, it's hopeless. But then, you know, you can dwell on it and drive yourself into the ground, and yet with the idea that it's really not that serious, it doesn't really matter. You can kind of relieve it. So that's my take on it.
Mado?
Responding to Chris's comment about appeasement, I'm thinking maybe here is an opportunity for the middle way. That is, we don't give way in that sense of appeasement, simply give way to our fixed ideas or obsessiveness, but also that we are friendly toward that. And I'm thinking of this metaphor of the root, of digging out roots. And I've seen you and Giroux studying in a friendly way, studying those roots to see how to really get them out completely. And you can't do that unless you're friendly. But you have to be empathic with those roots. You have to engage with them in a friendly way. And if you just start hacking away at them, it's probably going to damage you as well as the roots. So this combination of kind of forcefulness and strength and determination that to engage directly with a fixed idea, and also in the spirit of understanding and compassion and friendliness, because you can't really get the job done unless you have that friendly attitude. So maybe there is that this middle way.
Mm-hmm. And then through the appeasement of obsessions, there's the auspicious, the state of grace, and you can't fight your way into that state of grace. That I like the term state of grace better than nirvana, because nirvana almost seems like it's there's no activity involved, whereas a state of grace is a synchronicity. And a nirvana does include that. I need to study that more. I don't know. But
the etymology of nirvana, sometimes it's associated with extinction of afflictions, and extinction of obsession, extinction in the sense of they use a metaphor of the flame going out. It's like the fuel of the fire is, you're no longer, the fire is no longer fit. So because the fire is no longer flooded, separate from its fuel, so it releases. And the actual term they use is not extinction itself, but actually to unbind. So the obsession is released from, it's unbound from its causes, whatever its causes are, which is what we're talking about. So actually, it works.
It works,
in
okay.
that sense, yeah.
Yeah. So state of grace can be
unbound,
yeah.
Unboundness or something
mm-hmm.
like that. Yeah. Good. The same thing as grace. Because
mm-hmm.
grace implies a kind of liberation, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of release or something. Or union, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's time to have union with our lunch.
Yes, it's ready.
So,
just a quick question.
Yes.
You said there is an end to all this desire. So you said that, look, you are hungry, that's the desire. And finally you eat and you feel satisfied. So is this okay? Therefore, is this okay to have those desires? Or has to be stopped or be calmed? I didn't understand. Like, it's okay to have those desires?
They come up, yes. It is okay to have desires. And to, instead of fighting them, to embrace them and ride with them, with our full body and mind, and then watch. Just be with that, and then the desire is assuaged and there's new understanding of the desire, of the conditions, of the satisfactions, the repercussions. One of the problems with eating ice cream and having desire for ice cream is it quickly disappears. And hopefully you've had enough, but you know where to get more. And so desires are okay. To me, that's part of the interaction that we as human beings have with our lives and the world. So but people who are smokers, you know, it's like that's an obsession. And so how do they deal with, I'll have one more. Or do you stop? And sometimes people can just cut it off. Sometimes it's appropriate to cut, to just sever that. Sometimes it's appropriate. But back to our chanting the confession and repentance and atonement verses. We make mistakes all the time, every day. And with our desires, give us a chance to examine those. So to me, I haven't fully learned my mistakes until I've done just about every mistake I can. Which means staying with my desires until it's like, I don't need that anymore. You know, and then it's like, so that one's gone. That's, in a way, that desire is gone. But, so does that help a little? How do you think that is okay?
I wasn't sure that, okay, what should you do with approach? With hunger or being thirsty or gasp of air, I understand because they are like, you know, they are small. You know, you eat a little bit and you feel full, or you need air, you go out and you get air. But for big things, big desires, I don't know how to deal with them. Should we calm them, ignore them, put them aside, put it in the back of your head, or
like a big, would you consider needing material like a new car?
A Ferrari.
Okay, so that's a big desire. There's a lot of steps before you get to actually putting the money down to buy the Ferrari. So, let me use another example of I'll stay with that example of the Ferrari. So you have this huge desire for the Ferrari. You don't have the money. You don't have $100,000 or $300,000 for your Ferrari. So it's like, okay, I'm going to start putting money away. And then as you're putting money away for that Ferrari, you're reading about the Ferraris, you're dreaming about the Ferraris, you're feeling yourself drive it, and maybe you even have a friend who has one, so you go for a ride. And you continue investigating as you approach this cliff of buying the Ferrari. So you continue engaging that desire, and you learn more about Ferraris. You learn more about your desire for the Ferraris. You find out how much work it is. And you go to the showrooms and you look at the Ferraris, and you like the red one. But there's a metallic blue one that you really like. So it's like, which of these two is it going to be? But I have another $20,000 to go. And so you're just, how can you get there? There are still a dozen or more steps before you get to finally buying the Ferrari. It might be you lose your job, or it might be there's another emergency that comes up that postpones that desire. Or it might be everything's coming together, where the money's coming in. You know who you're going to buy it from. You know the car you're going to get. And it all works. And so you've built up this whole desire. It's culminating in bringing the $200,000 to buy that Ferrari. And then you do... Huh?
500.
Okay, well, I'll start with two. It's not that big a desire. And then, so there's been this buildup of the anticipation. So there's the anticipation in the desire of getting it. There's the getting it part, which doesn't take very long. In buying a car, in getting the wedding ceremony, a lot of these things, it doesn't take long. It's like 30 minutes, you know, the acquiring of the thing. And then there's the
buyer's remorse.
Third item, buyer's remorse, or the enjoyment of that which you just got, and the problems around that, because then there's a whole new set of problems around the result. So I got one friend who likes to go window shopping and makes use of that wishing for part, the beginning part, and, oh, I'd really like that dress, and then doesn't go into the store, just already smells it, feels it, maybe even goes into the store to feel the fabric and look at it and think about it, but then I don't have the money, and leaves. So there's tremendous amount of enjoyment out of just that first part of the anticipation. And then there's then when you buy the dress, you have a party you're going to wear it for, and then the dress sits in the closet for the next 5-10 years, and then as you get older, because these bodies age, then does it fit anymore? Who do I give it to? What do I do with it? And I spent $1,000 for that dress. You know, it's like, so to, I see that desires, there's the anticipation, there's the fulfillment, and then there's the culmination of the desire and the afterness of it. And so to see our desires in a time frame like that might be useful too, to put them in perspective. of what part of that desire you like. Is it the build-up? Is it the culmination? Is it the afterness? Or is it all of it? And what do you want? But as you go through it, like how many times are you going to go through and buy a Ferrari? You know, in one's life, you could maybe a person, if they worked really, really hard, maybe they could get five or ten of them. Depending on what, maybe some guys can buy 10 of them at one time. But still, then they have these 10 cars they have to take care of. And as soon as you buy the car, its value drops, usually, unless it's an antique. But the desire, so I think it's nice to be able to play with our desires, and that's useful. Instead of shoving them down, but to play with our desires, love, like the woman who likes to go window shopping, or the the would-be woodworker that's looking through the catalogs and going to the wood carver shops to see what kind of tools they have, and oh man, I want one of those. I really want one of those, and the types of wood that they have, and it's like, oh my God, how can I get that? You know, there's all that just that flush of juice that you get. But to recognize that, to have a beeline from having the desire to getting it, that's, and then forgetting about all of the problems associated with, I think it's useful to examine our, you know, then we're not as bound by our desires if we can also play with it more. So it's important to not be bound by, but also play with our desires, is how I would approach this.
A little different than obsessions. Maybe it's a little branch which meet the obsession, having a huge desire. It's the obsession of having it, wanting it, not needing it.
Mm-hmm. Wanting it, but not needing it. And so, at what point do you see that you don't need it?
If it's necessary or just you want to have something like, because we can have a lot of different desires. We all want to have a lot of different things, you know, good things for mm-hmm. ourselves. But as you mentioned, you know, the problem could come after the war. After you having it, you know, how to maintain it and keeping it. So that's a whole different thing. Now, I was going to ask you a question. The obsessions, how do you define that compared to desire? What is the difference exactly? Because what I hear from you that, you know, having a huge desire about something particular, well, then what's the obsession?
Well, there could. I think they're not exclusive. I think there's words that can be used together, like an obsession for or a desire for Ferrari. It's a particular thing that you're after. But obsessions can not only be desires, but they can also be, for example, an expectation, like. The way a person cuts a piece of wood, it's done this way, only this way, and no other way. And so some guy comes and cuts a piece of wood a different way, and it's like, you didn't do it right. You know, then that guy has an obsession of a fixed view, a fixed approach. It has nothing to do with desire, but it's still an obsession. So desires can be full of... can be laden with, loaded with obsessions. But so I think desires are just, obsessions is a huge, big mix of things. And so desires are part
of the obsession.
Delusions are another part. Prejudices would be another part. You know, so obsessions kind of includes desires.
So the whole thing is to control it. Is it good things to control it, or just go after it, or let it go, or
There are a lot of ways of controlling it. You know, Christopher talked about coming in from the side. You know, there are these side doors. So you can try and control, but maybe you play with it too. And so you loosen the control, you tighten the control, and you see, oh, I really want that, but do I really want it? What if I got this? You know, so you play with it. And then after a while, it's like, it's important to go through these our desires many times, because the first time it's like, okay, I had that desire, now I don't need it anymore. But then you get hungry again, so you go for more food, and some people refine that, keep refining it, so it's like, oh, the best food. I only want the best food on Friday night, and it's got to be $100 meal, and it's got to be fish, the freshest fish. And so there's these obsessions. You start going that way. And so to witness your obsessions and how particular they are might be useful to be able to say, ah, but look at this homeless guy who just got, somebody gave him $5 and he went and got a sandwich. And he's just so happy. He's so happy with just that little sustenance. There's magic to that. And so an openness of our approach is I think the primary message of how we approach our life is to be open to our desires, open to how we solve our desires, open and then familiar with them, and then after a while, like, you know, a person who smokes a lot, you know, initially as a kid, I like smoking Pall Malls and Gauloises and some of these filterless cigarettes. It was like, yeah, you know. And then it's like, yeah, now I'm like the Marlboro Man. I'll get a hat like the Marlboro Man. But after a while, it's like, this is killing me. I'm not, enough of this. And you're done. So to be virtuous, like, I don't have any desires. I'm done with them. I'm done with them all. I can say no to all my desires. Maybe there are people that can do that. I think the Buddha figured out a way to flip on the desires and actually have a perspective of it, of like, you recognize, you mentioned Saeed, right?
Yes.
That you get something, you have a desire for something, and you get it. And then there are a whole set of problems that you have after that of maintaining it and paying for it, you know, the upkeep on it and the insurance on it and all that other. And you have to use it. If you don't use it and it's an expensive object, that's another problem. And so as you go through your desires, more and more you're familiar with your anticipations, the culminations, and the afterness. And after a while, after you've been through three or four Ferraris, and you realize, enough, I don't want this one anymore. I'm done with this. And so one by one, our desires, as Cliff said, they go. Desires end of themselves.
They find an end of themselves.
Desires find an end of themselves. So it's okay to embrace our desires and study them. To mindlessly engage in them, that's where they just get repeated again and again. But to examine them, that's where it's like, oh, enough of that one. Now into more important things. Yeah. So you had one more comment?
Yeah, just that it appears to me, I think, that it desires a form of suffering. I think that's written somewhere, I've chanted it, so it's in a bigger word, capital S, in multiple myriad ways which you can interpret that. But coming back to this metaphor of Ferrari and so forth and all that you have to attain, and then you realize maybe after doing all this incredible suffering, really, to get this thing, but actually you have to know how to drive it. And that turned out to be what you had to do when you had the Volkswagen. Learn how to drive it. And you never learn how to drive it. So it's a great deep reflection on obsession to come to that fact, oh my God, I got this Ferrari and I can't drive it because I want to drive it on a public road. It's not even meant for a public road. I see that where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know how to drive it. So it's incredibly binding, this obsession, and yet also a great way of reflecting, finally maybe, on what is liberating or what is imprisoning you.
Mm-hmm.
So they're great teaching.
Mm-hmm. Well, keep these, please take these with you. And let's put our seats back and then we'll bow out together. Thank you.